Beyond Brunel, talking about the future of infrastructure in the Southwest from the Southwest Infrastructure Partnership, supported by ICE Southwest.
A very warm welcome back to Beyond Brunel. Today we're discussing nature and asking the question, can infrastructure really be positive for nature in the Southwest? I'm joined in the studio by Ed Whitelaw, Director of Nature and Neighbourhoods at Real Ideas Organisation, and online by Martin Rule, Lead Advisor of Nature-Based Solutions at the Environment Agency. A very warm welcome, Ed and Martin. I'll kick off by asking Martin, what do we mean by nature-based solutions?
I think it means where we realise that nature is intrinsic, you know, the whole, we are part of nature. And I think we as a species, of humankind, mankind has spent many, many years trying to maybe control nature, maybe feel like we know best, go ahead regardless, possibly. I don't mean this is a deliberate thing, maybe, but there's a lot of us around now, aren't there, compared to many years ago. You look at the population growth globally in Britain as well. I think most people are realizing that actually it's not okay to keep pushing against nature. Maybe it's a new buzzword for something that's always been around with a lot of people that, you know, used to be called soft engineering years ago, didn't it? It's looking at a whole range of solutions that we can explore in a little while about working with nature to try to minimize, avoid impacts so that we can still live as a society how we want to live. But I think, having said that, recognizing that there are ultimate constraints set by the parameters we live in, planet Earth, you know.
I think that's really useful. And I guess there's more than one way of describing it. So, Ed, what does nature-based solutions mean to you?
I really like actually what Martin said there. And it's moving on from, you know, nature is something that we push against and fight against. And what I suppose I'm interested in the language we use is how is nature a partner? And how do we work with that in a way that is beneficial to it, which is ultimately beneficial to us, but also beneficial to us in the way of doing that? And I suppose when I come to, you know, in the world of infrastructure, we work with social infrastructure. That often means community buildings, cultural buildings, heritage buildings, the buildings that exist within our communities that sort of tie us all together and make our communities a great place to be and serve us and do all those things that we often like doing. And I'm really interested in, and I see some of these examples of some of the people that we work with who have those buildings and operate them buildings, and how they found ways to move beyond this idea, which was where we were 5-10 years ago, is like, actually, we're going to run our business, and if we make kind of enough money, we might do something for nature and environment at the end if we can afford it. But it's a cost, it's something that we have to find time and resource to do. To thinking about their business really carefully, being really innovative and really creative, and saying, actually, how can I do something within our building, our space, that not only benefits nature, and through doing that, that actually drives and improves our business model and our social impact to our communities. And it's those kind of examples that I'm seeing emerging that are really, really exciting. And it's, let's move on from some of the nature-based solutions. That's kind of the world where I see that kind of thing happening.
If you think of nature, you know, that extends from the climate is nature right down to an individual species that you might bump up against in your garden. So it's a huge, broad topic that we're dealing with. As Ed was saying, you know, perhaps in the past, even till recently, it's been a little bit around, well, I'm going to build this thing. And if somebody forces me, sometimes through planning, occasionally they want to do it just out of the goodness of their heart. They'll make a part of the development as a positive thing. But it's kind of like ticking a box, isn't it? Let's be honest. Whereas I think there's a gradual realization that really, if we're genuine about trying to protect the environment going forward for us to live successfully, I'm talking globally, then we need to make broad scale changes. And it starts with our attitude, doesn't it?
Ed, is this not an element of greenwashing? You know, what's all the hype about?
There is important national, international scale change that needs to happen. And that needs the weight of government and international treaties around it. And obviously, I think nationally and internationally, we can see the problems with that. How optimistic I am about the future. I mean, if I look up at, you know, what's going on internationally and nationally, I feel quite depressed. But if I look sort of out and around me, what's going on in our communities, I see some really innovative, clever behaviour that's going on. And so I try and focus my energy there. What can I do in the world around me? And what can we make a difference with the people in our community? How can we get together and use whatever organised or economic power we have to make a change? There I get a bit more excited. And there I see actually organisations being really clever. So I'll give you an example of one organisation I want to talk to, which is a children's theatre company called Stiltskin, and they run the Soapbox Theatre, which is in Devonport Park, not far from here. And first of all, they're recycling a building, which is actually a building built in the Second World War, which is a mustard gas decontamination centre. And they've turned that into a children's theatre. It's basically a concrete block, which they're knocking down and chucking away, and they're doing carbon sensible way. They've repurposed that building to a children's theatre. And the work that we've been doing, and we've supported by Plymouth City Council and Natural England and various other partners involved in this, is thinking about a way that how can they support nature but also grow their business. Moving abroad from the idea it's a choice, it's one or the other. And what they've managed to do is not only repurpose this building, great, one tick, not only make it energy efficient, one tick, and also good for the environment and the business, but also they managed to take on the licensing and the responsibility and the co-stewardship of the green space and the land around that building. What they've added into that, which is now a nature garden and an educational area, so they've planted, restored, reintroduced nature. That's also great for nature, but that's also a new product and service where they work with children and groups and young people, so that's growing their business, growing nature, making a nicer space in the park. It also managed to engage much more the local community because they're out and about doing stuff and people are walking past and talking about what's that thing you're doing, what's that green man kind of thing. But the really exciting bit is that because they've taken on about half an acre of the land, which they can just use now for their own purposes, then they can now do outdoor shows. That's pushed up their ticket sales by 75%. So it's that very, very interesting, and it's a small scale stuff, but it's really, really innovative, and it's really at the edge of thinking, actually, nature is my partner. If I can work with that in a really interesting way, not only does nature and the community around here benefit socially, and we all know how nature and health have a big connection, but actually, my business grows and my business gets better. Mm. And it's that kind of small scale thinking that people are doing independently, regardless of the arguments that go on and drag on internationally and don't always get to the place we want to go. It is really exciting. And it's that end of the scale that I find myself getting hopeful about, even though there's a lot more to do.
Completely echo what you say, Ed. The role I'm in now at the Environment Agency is relatively new for me. I did work for the EA many years ago. In the bit in between, I was self-employed as an ecologist and various environmental jobs, the most recent one of which was as a ranger on the Towans at Hale. One of the things that I used to really enjoy down there was getting school groups out, you know, primary school children especially, get them outside and actually inspire them in nature, literally in nature. I mean, post-pandemic, the climate concerns children have, the eco-anxiety. My wife is a counsellor and she was meeting people and she still does. These children, they have incredibly severe, some of them, anxieties, sometimes eco-anxiety. So the least we can do, surely, is to help them come outside and get experienced in nature, really close, as you were saying, Ed, in the garden outside that new development. Inspire them to be hopeful and positive. Do something. If we all do small things, they do add up. I know it's a cliche, but they really do. It's not a new concept.
So there's huge benefits for the community, Ed, in engaging with nature. But as infrastructure professionals or working on infrastructure projects, doesn't nature just get in the way?
Well, it depends what you're trying to do, of course. And I think you work in water and things like that. And actually, isn't it about working with nature and making the best out of that? So it depends what you do. And I think for some people, for the business and what they're trying to achieve, which is essentially capital-driven, money-driven, bottom-line, quarterly report-driven, for them, they might see that as nature as a problem, and that's a problem for all of us. So we need to be on the front foot of challenging those companies, questioning if we want to be buying their product or their services, and putting pressure on government to introduce new things. And there are some really exciting new things. I mean, I've been critical of government so far in the Environmental Act and the idea of sort of biodiversity net gain, which has some really interesting potential. So partially we need regulation, and regulation from government often sets us free. It's not something that change us back. It actually allows us to do things and keep doing things. So I think that's a good place and we need that, which does change behaviour. But coming back to where we started, actually, nature is a partner. If we can be creative and smart, we can find ways that actually thinking environmentally saves cost. Working with nature can actually improve buildings and businesses. And in fact, you can think of a number of famous buildings which have fantastic green walls and they're iconic and they're beautiful and people love them. And they're actually really, really good products as buildings. So it doesn't have to be, but it can be. And sadly, it still is in many cases. And some people will think about that and we need to challenge it.
The aspect of insulation, you know, to try and reduce the heat going out of buildings and emissions or what have you. I mean, that's obviously minimizing an effect on nature. It may not be the same as not building your building on a wildflower meadow, but it's equally valid, if not more so, perhaps these days with the way of carbon going. So, yeah, I mean, I spent a lot of my working life dealing with nature's in the way context, you know, or having that posed to me, if you like. And I think sometimes it's just completely belligerent and nature is in the way, and that's just tough, you know, and it's a battle. More often it's not. If we can engage properly, openly with environmentalists and ecologists at an early stage in any project to get designs as sensitive as they can be, then it doesn't have to be in the way, and it can enhance the development, as Ed was saying. It can certainly avoid impacts downstream, further on in time, all that kind of thing. And we do know these things now, so we ought to be putting it into practice on a wider scale.
In the green debate, talking about nature, I think it's really interesting and really important because, you know, I think it was YouGov last year, 3/4 of people in this country will state that actually they're worried about nature and the state of nature. And nature, because I work in nature and heritage, and those two things are actually, they're quite inclusive ideas. They're quite good things. They're quite a good party to invite people to. I'm doing some work in our community and we have a sort of Green Devonport partnership meeting. It's really well attended. You know, I try to get meetings together about all sorts of things, but the nature one is really well attended because people generally care about nature. They like things looking nice and they like a tree and they like this. So it's quite an accessible point, but also it brings local government and it brings that. It also brings business. It's not a controversial subject for most people. So it's quite a good way into having a conversation about the environment. Because, you know, most people in this country, a vast majority actually like a bird and a tree and a forest and all these kind of things and see nature in the local areas. So it's quite a useful, powerful place to push on for change. Maybe those businesses or those politicians who do think nature gets in the way, I think they're powerful and they're often powerful because of those positions. But I think they are in a vast majority. We've got to look at the evidence that actually they are not on the popular side of history in the debate at the moment. And I think most of them are starting to realise that.
Far more could be made of the scale of membership of the wildlife organisations that far outweighs all political parties put together. You know, I think we'd be missing a trick making more of that maybe.
Absolutely. In such a divided world, that's a really good point. Mm. In such a divided world that's shot through with disinformation and culture wars, where we're all being told that we're against each other, actually, right, left, young, old, whatever divisions you want to falsely make about society, actually nature is really good at bringing people together. And how do we understand that and make better use of that in terms of the big changes we need to make about the environment and our society, I think is really a big question, an important one.
And Martin, do you think there's a disconnect between people's view of nature and what we might provide as professionals? So the sorts of measures I'm talking about are leaving verges unkept for biodiversity and, you know, roundabouts and so on. Do people really understand that, do you think?
Probably there's an awful lot to always do about information. I hate to say education, that sounds patronising, but informing, just explaining why things are being done. I mean, sometimes, let's be honest, it is simply a cost-saving exercise, or a council doesn't have the funds they used to have to maintain a certain area. But very often, okay, that might be part of the reason, but there is another reason, a beneficial reason, if you like, for leaving areas. We just need to endlessly describe why. I don't want to say educate, but it is.
It's a really good conversation, I think, and it's a really live debate. We have the opportunity to privilege working with the local authority here that's really good in the front foot about lots of urban nature restoration and organisations like Natural England and the Heritage Lottery Fund and people like that and our local residents, and looking at what's urban nature restoration look like and what does that mean with communities and by communities. Because, you know, 86% of us live in cities and I think there's an important angle there. What's interesting, we're doing a piece of research with Plymouth University. Because we're talking about urban nature restoration in our environment, morally, practically, people need to have an important say in that. Because if you don't have a say, well, you know, there's a democratic argument that people need to be involved and need to come to consensus. One of the early where you might start to see areas of division is around this point that you've just raised, is does good nature need to be messy? Because everybody will say, yeah, we like more nature, but there's definitely a sort of camp which is keep it nice and neat, and I like some roses. but blitz all the weeds in the street. And so that's a really interesting, important place to have a discussion. And how we start having that discussion, if we go to talk to Martin about his experience of that, how do we bring people with us and find a consensus and get the evidence out and have the conversations and find the right balance between make it what's good for nature, which is often not particularly neat, and you know, there's no straight lines in nature and it likes to do what it wants, but also having an aesthetically pleasing community that works for people that doesn't look like a mess. We're quite early on in this piece of work. That's going to be one of the lines that we're going to need to find consensus about.
Yeah, you haven't even started talking about the different views of wilding, you know, within ecology. So yes, what you say is true, Ed.
Rewilding. Urban wilding works. Urban rewilding apparently doesn't work. So, you know, it's language becomes really important.
Yeah. Again, this isn't a new thing, is it? We're still only talking about lots of different people making lots of different choices on the same bits of land. That's just what humans have always done. So it's just where we are now.
Yeah. Totally.
I mean, I was thinking yesterday about Brunel, you know, obviously preparing for this. I was wondering, you know, did he have carte blanche to sort of just go for it? Did he have an endless budget? I don't know. These are genuine questions. Was he given free rein? Or did people sort of try and constrain him? You know, we think if the legacy's left, it's fantastic what he achieved transport-wise alone in this region. I know there were certain landowners that didn't want the railway to come along and elsewhere in the country. So I know for a fact he didn't have carte blanche, obviously. But what struck me thinking about that was that back then, the big difference to now is far fewer people, less pressure and loads more wildlife. So maybe he wouldn't have been held to account in the same way as people are now. I don't know what your thoughts might be on that. It was a random thought in the middle of the night.
I think you're probably right. I mean, I think there weren't the pressures that we experience today in terms of population and demand. Conversely, though, I think, you know, as long as you kept the people with money and government, which are more or less the same people at that time, and Queen Victoria happy, he could probably do what he wanted. I think the more middle and lower classes who might have had their train steam through their field probably didn't have any say at all or any rights. I mean, how much they have these days now is an interesting question, and how much things are different. You'd debate that one.
Beyond Brunel, talking about the future of infrastructure in the Southwest. From the Southwest Infrastructure Partnership, supported by ICE Southwest. Search for us on LinkedIn, follow us on Twitter at SWIP Partnership and at ICE Southwest.
Martin, people and place, they're inherently linked. But how do we give them more of a voice when we're making decisions about our infrastructure?
I've got an example that might help to answer that question. So the Sturt Marshes up in North Somerset, it's easy for us to sort of sit in our dry houses, isn't it, and think it's going to be okay. But the horrible fact is that significant parts of the coast are going to be lost, you know, within the next decades to erosion, sea level rise, all of it. A particular area at risk is North Somerset, Sedgemoor, as well as significant parts of the Cornish coast, South Devon, North Devon. With that in mind, there was a significant project that's been developed at Sturt Marshes to restore a huge area of salt marsh, you know, intertidal salt marsh. And I was reading up about it just the other day. And apparently, because they had a whole range of meetings with the local residents, you know, Environment Agency and the councils, they worked with people genuinely. They changed plans as they went along. And apparently there was no planning objections. When the planning application came in, eventually, there were no planning objections and all the land for the scheme. And I'm not sure of the hectareage, but it's quite a massive, it's the largest fairly new wetland in the country. All the land was voluntarily sold, you know, for the scheme. So those two facts alone, there are no objections on the planning and the voluntary selling of land. To me, that says that you can do it if you work genuinely with people. A colleague said to me the other day about this acronym DAD that I've not heard, where an organisation might decide something, then it might announce that it's going to do such and such a thing, and then it might spend years having to defend that it's done such and such a thing, you know? And that's just not right, is it? You know, we need to be genuinely inclusive with people, because that's how we would want to be surely involved in a thing if it affected our garden or our backyard or our village, surely. So it's just about involving people properly and not paying lip service to it. And it's possible. And what Ed was saying just now with the work you're doing in Devonport, you know.
I totally agree. I suppose coming back to some of our earlier points, there's still a lot of people who prefer a dad approach in positions of power and positions of government, and that is unfortunate. You want to flip it around. You want to have that conversation and invest in that conversation and invest in working with communities. And it's all a sort of difficult thing for people concerned about budgets and parliamentary terms and things like that. If you spend the money up front and you invest up front, you will get better, cheaper, more efficient solutions down the line. But it's often hard to sort of get past that short-term thinking and those short-term costs. But, you know, if you have more, not just participative, but deliberative democratic processes, which we're seeing really lead and be pioneered within the environmental field, people do kind of get there enough to be able to move past, I suppose, arguments, rhetoric, culture wars, disinformation, shouting at each other on social media. And actually people are able to come together and often form consensus around some of the things that we desperately need consensus around. And yeah, it's on the edges. It's actually within the environmental movement, you're seeing a lot of this happen. And within good local government practice, you're seeing this happen. A couple of examples you may be familiar with. We're currently working with the People's Plan for Nature, which came out, which is a big citizen assembly process, World Wildlife Fund, RSPB, National Trust. And that's a project that's now coming forward into communities, into here in Plymouth. And we have support from them and through National Lottery Community Fund to develop a local People's Plan for Nature across the west of the city, Keyham and Devonport, which is about bringing that process to, OK, what's that mean here for our communities and how do communities come up with their own local plan, 2-year process. So that's a really exciting program which came out of a large citizens assembly, big democratic process of lots of people coming together. And you're also seeing the use of new environmental e-democracy technology coming out. And I think I saw Bliner Gwent and is it Newham Borough Council, two councils used e-democracy tool Polis to come up with their climate emergency plan, which is a really interesting, very simple piece of software that not only gets a sense of what people think about a subject, but also points to where there might be consensus and areas of tension. And I think we're in a conversation with Plymouth University about how we can make use of that some here. So how do we, coming back to actually have really good conversations, good relationships with people over time, and if we can do that, we can often find our way through what are often quite deeply polarised debates about certain issues. And in the bigger scheme of things, that's cheaper, more efficient, and gets you to a quicker place in the end than actually a sort of decide, act, defend process.
You're completely right. There is a slight caveat, of course, with anything involving, you know, too much committee, if you like, approach, is that you can risk talking things around forever. And we need to crack on with this, don't we? There's a fantastic range of individuals and organisations, professionals and volunteers, amateurs, you know, everybody who knows an awful lot to contribute to the debate and then join it up and deliver it. Something I keep banging on about, yes, I do actually, and also in my head, all these strategies and plans are great, but we need to actually get things delivered on the ground. So, I mean, Ed, you were talking about biodiversity net gain earlier. Now, I've spent a lot of my career dealing with planning applications, and the first principle usually is, going back to what one of you said earlier, is nature in the way. So firstly, you try and avoid an impact on nature. It might be you object to a development on a certain site. Sometimes you win, often you didn't. Then you're into that, well, what crumbs can we pick up and sort of maintain and put a box up here and there? You know, kind of mediocre stuff, some of it, let's be fair. So I must admit, biodiversity net gain as a concept, to me, I thought, actually, in a way, it's positive. Okay, so yes, developers should first of all try to avoid the impacts where that's possible, put right things on the site where they can. But lots of my dealings over the years, I've realized that it's a little bit of greenwashing, as you said earlier, that actually you're paying lip service that you've done something good, but really that place has had a net loss to biodiversity. So biodiversity net gain potentially involves, okay, let's accept that we can't sort what we need to sort on the site. Let's generate some money. And I think this is where it sort of makes people feel uncomfortable, maybe. Money goes to another site to do some good work. Now, if there's enough of those sites contributing to these really meaningful projects, I call them sites, you know, these projects where well-planned, well-designed, beneficial schemes can be put in place that really do deliver good outcomes, isn't that a good thing? But we've got to find those places. We need to encourage those landowners that this will be a good use of their land. That's obviously a discussion to be had, but I think it's got some merit. And it's certainly a whole different way of looking at it than even 5 years ago, let alone 25.
And just to pick up on that, Martin, what exactly do you mean by biodiversity net gain? Just to spell it out to our listeners.
All developments in England are going to have to demonstrate that not only are they having no impact on biodiversity, but actually they're delivering a gain of 10% for each development. So there's very complicated metric worked out, designed by Natural England. It's a real head stretch. I can see Ed nodding there. So I'm not pretending to be anything like an expert on it. I don't know if anyone is yet. But it's going to be a measurable way where all developments will have to prove that they can have their development, yes, but through a planning condition, they are required to demonstrate an increase through their development. I mean, it's a big deal. You know, it's not something that I imagine was even dreamt up when I was studying or working early years ago. But the devil's always in the detail, isn't it, in the delivery.
You're absolutely right there, Martin. I think it's going to be down to how local authorities particularly interpret and put local plans into place, and how crafty people with money and lawyers find interesting loopholes and exploitation within that. Coming back to where I work, and in an urban community that is not the wealthiest community in the world and has challenges, wonderful place that it is, but, you know, it's a deprived community, as are many of the, you know, the communities around the country and here in Plymouth. I suppose what I'm really interested in, and there's some very good work going on in Plymouth around this, is that what we want to avoid is, say, if, you know, you're going to chuck up a new building in Devonport, they can't do the mitigation on the site, they can't create new nature in the urban environment locally, so they're going to pay the money. And what I'd want to see avoided is that actually landowners in nice, green, leafy places go setting themselves up going, hi, I can deliver your biodiversity net gain. Give me your money and I'll make my nice, leafy, walled, often private estate even greener and nicer. So actually what's happening there, something very unjust, is actually something's been extracted from a poorer, marginalised community and put into and supporting a rather wealthy landowner. I think that's where the problems are. And I think we've already seen cases of some landowners sort of mobilising around that. What I want to see, and what Plymouth is planning around, is, okay, we want to make sure any biodiversity net gain money that is generated within city, and the city council is a substantial landowner, is spent and stays within the city. And not only that, and this is what I hope will happen, we're not going to just actually invest that money in our own nature reserves, which, you know, are really nice anyway and often in more affluent areas. We're going to actually think about how we distribute that fairly and justly across the city. Because if we don't make sure that this wider green movement is a just transition, we see all sorts of kickbacks will be exploited. If it's actually people see the green movement and actually that's a cost that's layered on working people and a benefit for the more well-off, that's going to undermine the whole green movement, and we've got to be really careful about that. We need fair and just transition. And you see actually some very good planning in Plymouth around that, and I encourage other local authorities to do the same and understand and think in those ways.
Can't disagree at all. I was just thinking in terms of, I can see one challenge here. We're looking at administrative boundaries. Where I work, obviously, we look at catchment. So just give you an example. So let's just say there's flooding issues in Plymouth that could be partially, if not fully, solved by nature-based solutions further upstream, okay, outside Plymouth City Council. But if sites are identified genuinely, whoever owns the land, but if those particular topographical locations could have beneficial work done on them, nature-based solutions to hold back floodwater, make the soils more porous, all those kind of things, leaky dams, introduce beavers, there's a whole menu, then that's going to benefit Plymouth, although it's outside your administrative boundary. So I think the debate needs to be a little bit wider across the boundary. It's easy in Cornwall because you've only got one one administrative authority, but your fairness about where the money's spent, I completely get it. Yes, and it's something we need to be very sensitive about. If we want to solve or try to solve some of these environmental problems, it's going to come down to particular locations where that would need to be done, because it can just be somewhere random. And that's what colleagues of mine and other organisations we're wrestling with at the moment, trying to knit together where several different parts of the Environment Agency will have our own problem sites, if you want to call them that. Cornwall Wildlife Trust, for example, will have areas in Cornwall and Devon where they want to restore habitat, link habitat that's fragmented. So there'll be other places, towns and cities, where they want to have more green space, you know, corridors where people can walk and what have you. We need to map and try and seek the overlaps for as many places as possible where there are overlaps, so you can get more for your money on those locations. The concern I have in my head is that those locations, the value of them financially will become elevated, like if you like in the old days with the local plans where you had land allocation. It used to increase the land values, didn't it, for those particular locations. So money always gets in the way, doesn't it? You say nature gets in the way, I say money gets in the way.
Yeah, nice.
Ed and Martin, there's some really good examples of where we're using nature in the Southwest to benefit communities and equally to benefit our infrastructure. One that comes to mind is the North Devon Biosphere and investing in natural capital and nature-based solutions. I wonder, have you got any further examples in the Southwest? Ed, perhaps we'll go to you first.
Yeah, I've talked about the Soapbox Theatre, which is one of my favourites. I'm fortunate enough to be working with a bunch of partners that are organisations that we've supported with various programmes. One of the ones I really love, and again, it's how they've brought together a business model that actually supports nature, and that's a social enterprise here in Plymouth called Pollenize, and they're essentially a bee and wildflower conservation organization. What I love about them is they're relatively young compared to me. They're kind of hip and they know, understand how to work a brand and social media. And essentially, whereas in the past you might actually go for a charitable model, nothing wrong with that, what they've come up with is a sort of membership sort of scheme. So yes, they roll out apiaries and they roll out wildflowers in urban spaces and across communities, and they make all that happen. So there's not really much money in honey and bee products unless you do it at industrial scale, which isn't very good for nature. But what they've done is they managed to create a brand which is popular and people subscribe. You know, you subscribe, you become a member. So, you know, as an individual become a member, it's £5 a month. And then bigger organisations, super supporters, you know, be it that we're one of the Real Ideas or I think the Theatre Royal or Babcock, and you get your set of beehives and you pay a sort of monthly subscription. That's really fantastic. They managed to bring together a business model, which is essentially a social media, more like business, which actually directly benefits nature. And the more better than nature does, and the more visible that is, and more people understand it, kicks back into their business model. And it's that kind of great thinking, which I really love.
Fantastic. And Martin, an example of where we're using nature really positively in the Southwest.
I want to go and look up that Ed was just talking about.
Become a member. Yeah, Pollenize CIC.
Sure. Well, Stover Country Park at Newton Abbot, I think they've just started a £2.1 million lottery fund. I think the National Highways contributed £848,000 on that. Reed beds to treat road runoff, but it's far more than that. There's a whole project there now developed around getting people outside, enjoying the nature, enjoying the park, restoring it. It's a big project. I mean, I mentioned Sturt Marshes earlier, North Somerset. There's also the Lower Otter Restoration Project down at Budley Salterton a few years ago now, but it was the A30 at Gosmoor in Cornwall. That was a scheme that ended up clipping a little bit off a European wildlife site, Gosmoor, and they treated the verges on the new road they made, the new dual carriageway. They treated them a little bit differently to the old traditional way, just in terms of how they designed the vegetation, the plants they put there, as well as loads of tunnels for mammals. I mean, I've been on that road too many times and I think hardly ever seen a mammal run over. So, you know, it's pretty basic stuff. It's not particularly cutting edge, but it just needs to be normal. You know, it needs to be just done more, doesn't it?
Thank you so much to our guests today. They were Martin Rawl, Lead Advisor of Nature-Based Solutions at the Environment Agency, and in the studio, Ed Whitelaw, Director of Nature and Neighbourhoods at Real Ideas Organisation. Thank you so much. It's been a brilliant discussion.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Beyond Brunel from the Southwest Infrastructure Partnership, supported by ICE Southwest. Search for us on LinkedIn. Follow us on Twitter at SWIP Partnership and at ICE Southwest. Beyond Brunel is presented by Christopher Ackland, a Fresh Air Studios production.